Obviously. But there's a big mirror hanging in the hall just inside the front door, and when Elsa stands on the stairs, she can see Kent's reflection in it. Britt-Marie is neatly turning down his shirt collar over the tie and gently brushing the lapel of his suit jacket.
"When are you coming home?" she asks in a low voice.
"I don't bloody know. You know how the Germans are. Don't wait up for me,"
Kent answers evasively, extricating himself and heading for the door.
"Put the shirt directly in the washing machine when you come in, please,"
says Britt-Marie, and comes padding after him to brush something from his trouser leg. Kent looks at his watch the way men with very expensive watches do when they look at them. Elsa knows that because Kent told Elsa's mum that his watch cost more than Kia.
"In the washing machine, please, Kent, directly, as soon as you come home,"
Britt-Marie calls out. Kent steps onto the landing without answering. He catches sight of Elsa. He doesn't seem to think she's been eavesdropping at all, but on the other hand, he doesn't look very pleased to see her.
"Yo," he says, with a grin. In that way, grown men say "yo" to children because they think that's how children talk.
Elsa doesn't answer, because she doesn't talk like that. Kent's telephone rings.
It's a new telephone, Elsa notices. Kent looks as if he'd like to tell her what it cost. "That's Germany calling," he says to Elsa,
and looks as if he's only just remembering that she was very much implicated in the cellar stairs-related incident yesterday that resulted in his last phone being rendered out of action. He looks as if he remembers the poison as well, and what it cost. Elsa shrugs, as if she's challenging him to a fight. Kent starts yelling,
"Yes, Klaus!"
into his new phone as he disappears down the stairs. Elsa takes a few steps towards the stairs but stops in the doorway. In the hall mirror she sees the bathroom. Britt-Marie is standing in there, carefully rolling up the lead of Kent's electric shaver before putting it in the third drawer. She comes out into the hall, catches sight of Elsa, folds her hands over her stomach.
"Oh, I see. I see," she starts. "I wasn't eavesdropping," says Elsa at once.
Britt-Marie straightens the coats on the hangers in the hall and carefully brushes the back of her hand over all of Kent's overcoats and jackets. Elsa shoves the tips of her fingers into the pockets of her jeans and mumbles,
"Thanks."
Britt-Marie turns round, surprised.
"Pardon me?"
Elsa groans like you do when you're almost eight and have to say thanks twice.
"I said thanks for not saying anything to the police about,"
she says, stopping herself before she says the worse. Britt-Marie seems to understand.
"You should have informed me about that horrible creature, young lady." "It's not a horrible creature."
"Not until it bites someone."
"It never will bite anyone, and it saved you from Sam," growls Elsa.
Britt-Marie looks as if she's about to say something, but she leaves it, because she knows it's true. And Elsa is going to say something, but she also leaves it, because she knows that Britt-Marie actually returned the favour. She looks into the flat, through the mirror.
"Why did you put the razor in the wrong drawer?" she asks.
Britt-Marie brushes her skirt, folds her hands.
"I don't know what you're talking about,"
she says, even though Elsa very well sees that she does.
"Kent said it was always in the first drawer, but you said it was always in the second drawer, and then after he'd gone, you put it in the third drawer," said Elsa.
And then Britt-Marie looks distracted for just a few moments. Then something else. Alone, perhaps. And then she mumbles,
"Yes, yes, maybe I did, maybe I did."
Elsa tilts her head.
"Why?"
And then there's a silence for an eternity of fairy tale silences. And then Britt-Marie whispers as if she's forgotten that Elsa is standing there in front of her.
"Because I like it when he shouts my name."
And then Britt-Marie closes the door. And Elsa stands outside and tries to dislike her. It doesn't go all that well. Chapter 29. Swiss Meringues. You have to believe. Granny always said that.
You have to believe in something in order to understand the tales.
It's not important what exactly you believe in, but there's got to be something, or you may as well forget the whole damn thing.
And maybe in the end, that's what everything, all of this, is about. Elsa finds her Gryffindor scarf in the snow outside the house, where she dropped it when she charged at Sam the night before. The green-eyed policewoman is standing a few meters away. The sun has hardly risen. The snow sounds like popcorn popping as she walks over it.
"Hello,"
offers Elsa. Green Eyes nods silently.
"You're not much of a talker, are you?"
Green Eyes smiles. Elsa wraps the scarf round herself.
"Did you know my granny?"
The policewoman scans along the house wall and over the little street. "Everyone knew your grandmother."
"And my mum?"
Green Eyes nods again. Elsa squints at her.
"Alf says you were best friends."
She nods again. Elsa wonders how that would feel. To have a best friend who's your own age. Then she stands in silence beside the policewoman and watches the sun come up. It's going to be a beautiful Christmas Eve, despite everything that's happened. She clears her throat and heads back to the front entrance, stopping with her hand on the door handle.
"Have you been on guard here all night?"
She nods again.
"Will you kill Sam if he comes back?"
"I hope not."
"Why not?"
"Because it's not my job to kill."
"What is your job then?"
"To protect."
"Him or us?"
Elsa asks reproachfully. "Both."
"He's the one who's dangerous, not us."
Green Eyes smiles without looking happy. "When I was small, your grandmother used to say that if you become a police officer, you can't choose who to protect. You have to try to protect everyone."
"Did she know you wanted to become a policewoman?"
asks Elsa. "She's the one who made me want to become one."
"Why?"
Green Eyes starts smiling, genuinely this time. "Because I was afraid of everything when I was small. And she told me I should do what I was most afraid of. I should laugh at my fears." Elsa nods, as if this confirms what she already knew.
"It was you and Mum, wasn't it? The Golden Knights that saved the Telling Mountain from the Nauin and the Fears and built Miodacus. It was you and Mum."
The policewoman raises her eyebrows imperceptibly. "We were many things in your grandmother's fairy tales, I think." Elsa opens the door, puts her foot in the opening and stops there.
"Did you know my mum first or my granny?"
"Your grandmother."
"You're one of the children on her bedroom ceiling, aren't you?"
Green Eyes looks directly at her. She smiles again, in the real way. "You're smart. She always said you were the smartest girl she ever met." Elsa nods. The door closes behind her. And it ends up being a beautiful Christmas Eve, despite everything. She looks for the worse in the cellar storage unit and in Renault, but they're both empty. She knows the wardrobe in Granny's flat is also empty. And the worse is definitely not in Mum and George's flat, because no healthy being can stand being there on a Christmas morning. Mum is even more efficient than usual at Christmas. She normally starts her Christmas shopping in May each year. She says it's because she's organised. Granny used to disagree and say it was actually because she was anal, and then Elsa used to have to wear her headphones for quite a long time. But this year, Mum decided to be a bit free-spirited and crazy, so she waited until the 1st of August before asking what Elsa wanted for Christmas. She was very angry when Elsa refused to tell her, even though Elsa expressly asked if she understood how much someone changes as a person in half a year when they're almost 8. So Mum did what Mum always does. She went and bought a present on her own initiative. And it went as it usually went, to hell. Elsa knew that because she knew where Mum hid her presents. What do you expect when you buy an almost 8-year-old her present 5 months early? So this year, Elsa is having 3 books that are about different themes in some way or other touched upon by various characters in the Harry Potter books. They're wrapped in a paper that Elsa likes very much. Elsa knows that because Mum's first present was utterly useless, and when Elsa informed her of that in October, They argued for about a month, and then Elsa's mum gave up and gave Elsa money instead, so she could go and buy what she wanted then. And then she wrapped them in a paper she liked very much, and put the parcel in Mum's not-so-secret place, and praised Mum for again being so considerate and sensitive that she knew exactly what Elsa wanted this year. And then Mum called Elsa a Grinch. Elsa had become very attached to this tradition. She rings on Alf's door half a dozen times before he opens. He's got his dressing gown on, his irritated expression, and his Juventus coffee cup.
"What's the matter?"
he barks. "Merry Christmas," says Elsa without answering the question.
"I'm sleeping," he grunts.
"It's Christmas morning," Elsa informs him.
"I do know that," he says.
"Why are you sleeping then?"
"I was up late last night."
"Doing what?"
Alf takes a sip of his coffee.
"What are you doing here?"
"I ask first," Elsa insists.
"I'm not the one standing at your door in the middle of the night."
"It's not the middle of the night, and it's Christmas."
He drinks some more coffee. She kicks his doormat irritably.
"I can't find the worse."
"I know that as well," nods Alf casually.
"How?"
"Because it's here."
Elsa's eyebrows shoot up as if they just sat down in wet paint.
"The worse is here?"
"Yes."
"Why didn't you say so?"
"I just bloody did."
"Why is it here?"
"Because Kent came home at 5 this morning and he couldn't sit on the stairs. Kent would have bloody called the police if he'd found out it was still in the house."
Elsa peers into Alf's flat. The worse is sitting on the floor, lapping at something in a big metal bowl in front of it. It says Juventus on it. The metal bowl, that is.
"How do you know what time Kent came home?"
"Because I was in the garage when he arrived in his BMW, bastard," says Alf impatiently.
"What were you doing in the garage?"
asks Elsa patiently. Alf looks as if that is an incredibly stupid question.
"I was waiting for him."
"How long did you wait?"
"Until 5 o'clock, I bloody said," he grunts.
Elsa thinks about giving him a hug, but leaves it. The worse peers up from the metal bowl, looking enormously pleased. Something black is dripping from its nose. Elsa turns to Alf.
"Alf, did you give the worse coffee?"
"Yes," says Alf, and looks as if he can't understand what could reasonably be wrong about that.
"It's an animal. Why did you give it coffee?"
Alf scratches his scalp, which for him is the same thing as scratching his hair. Then he adjusts his dressing gown. Elsa notices that he has a thick scar running across his chest. He sees her noticing and looks grumpy about it. Alf goes into his bedroom and closes the door, and when he comes out again, he is wearing his leather jacket with the taxi badge, even though it's Christmas Eve. They have to let the worse pee in the garage, because there are even more police outside the building now, and not even a worse can hold out for very long after drinking a bowl of coffee. Granny would have loved that one, peeing in the garage. It will drive Brit Marie to distraction. When they come up, Mum and George's flat smells of Swiss meringues and pasta gratin with béarnaise sauce, because Mum has decided that everyone in the house is having Christmas together this year. No one disagreed with her, partly because it was a good idea, and partly because no one ever disagrees with Mum. And then, George suggested that everyone should make their own favourite dish for a Christmas buffet. He's good like that, George, which infuriates Elsa. The boy with the syndrome's favourite food is Swiss meringue, so his mum made it for him. Well, his mum got out all the ingredients and Leonard picked all the meringues up off the floor, and Maud made the actual Swiss meringue while the boy and his mother were dancing. And then Maud and Leonard thought it was important that the woman in the black skirt also felt involved, because they're good like that, so they asked if she wanted to prepare anything in particular. She just sat glued to her chair at the far end of the flat and looked very embarrassed and mumbled that she hadn't cooked any food for several years.
"You don't cook very much when you live alone," she explained.
And then Maud looked very upset and apologised for being so insensitive. And then the woman in the black skirt felt so sorry for Maud that she made a pasta gratin with béarnaise sauce, because that was her boy's favourite dish. So they all have Swiss meringue and pasta gratin with béarnaise sauce, because that's the sort of Christmas it is. in spite of it all. The worse gets two buckets of cinnamon buns from Maud, and George goes to the cellar to fetch up the bathing tub Elsa had when she was a baby and fills it with mulled wine. With this as an incentive, the worse agrees to hide for an hour in the wardrobe in Granny's flat. And then Mum goes down and invites up the police outside the house. Green Eyes sits next to Mum. They laugh. The summer intern is there too. He eats the most Swiss meringue of them all and falls asleep on the sofa. The woman in the black skirt sits in silence at the table, in the far corner. After they've eaten, while George is washing up and Maud wiping down the tables and Lennart sitting on a stool with a standby cup of coffee, waiting for the percolator and making sure it's not going to get up to any tricks, the boy with a syndrome goes through the flat and crosses the landing and goes into Granny's flat. When he comes back, he has cinnamon bun crumbs all round his mouth and so many worse hairs on his jumper that he looks like someone invited him to a fancy dress party and he decided to dress up as a carpet. He gets a blanket from Elsa's room and walks up to the woman in the black skirt, looks at her for a long time, then reaches up, standing on his tiptoes, and pinches her nose. Startled, she jumps, and the boy's mother makes the sort of scream that mothers make when their children pinch complete strangers' noses and rushes towards him. But Maud gently catches hold of her arm and stops her. And when the boy holds up his thumb, poking out between his index finger and his long finger, while looking at the woman in the black skirt, Maud explains pleasantly, "It's a game. He's pretending he stole your nose." The woman stares at Maud, stares at the boy, stares at the nose, and then she steals his nose, and he laughs so loudly that the windows start rattling. He falls asleep in her lap, wrapped up in the blanket. When his mother, with an apologetic smile, tries to lift him off, observing as she does so that it's actually not at all like him to be so direct, the woman in the black skirt touches her hand tremulously and whispers, If it's all right, could I hold him a little longer?" The boy's mother puts both her hands round the woman's hand and nods. The woman puts her forehead against the boy's hair and whispers, "Thanks." George makes more mulled wine and everything feels almost normal and not at all frightening. After the police have thanked them for their hospitality and headed back down the stairs, Maud looks unhappily at Elsa and says she can understand it must have been frightening for a child to have police in the house on Christmas Eve. But Elsa takes her by the hand and says, "Don't worry, Maud. This is a Christmas tale. They always have a happy ending." And it's clear that Maud believes it. Because you have to believe. Chapter 30. Perfume. Only one person collapses with a heart attack late on Christmas Eve, but two hearts are broken, and the house is never quite the same again. It all starts with the boy waking up late in the afternoon and feeling hungry. The worse and Samantha come flopping out of the wardrobe because the mulled wine is finished. Elsa marches in circles round Alf and intimates that it's time to get the Santa suit. Elsa and the worse follow Alf down to the garage. He gets into taxi. When Elsa opens the passenger door and sticks her head in and asks what he's doing, he turns the ignition key and grunts, "If I have to impersonate Santa for the rest of the day, I'm nipping out for a newspaper first."
"I don't think my mum wants me to go anywhere."
"No one invited you."
Elsa and the worse ignore him and jump in. When Alf starts railing at her that you can't just jump into people's cars like that, Elsa says that this is actually taxi and that is precisely what one does with taxi. And when Alf grumpily taps the meter and points out that taxi journeys cost money, Elsa says that she'd like to have this taxi journey as her Christmas present. And then Alf looks very grumpy for a long time, and then they go off for Elsa's Christmas present. Alf knows of a kiosk that's open on Christmas Eve. He buys a newspaper. Elsa buys two ice creams. The worse eats all of its own and half of hers, which, if one knows how much worse is like ice cream, shows how immensely considerate it was being. It spills some of it in the back seat, but Alf only shouts at it for about 10 minutes, Which, if one knows how much Alf dislikes Worsus spilling ice cream in the back seat of taxi, shows how immensely considerate he was being.
"Can I ask you something?"
asks Elsa, even though she knows full well that this is also a question.
"Why didn't Britt Marie spill the beans about the worst to the police?"
"She can be a bit of a nagbag sometimes, but she's not bloody evil," Alf clarifies.
"But she hates dogs,"
Elsa persists.
"Ah, she's just scared of them. Your granny used to bring back loads of strays to the house when she moved in. We were just little brats back then, Britt Marie and Kent and me. One of the mutts bit Britt Marie and her mum made a hell of a commotion about it,"
Alf says, a shockingly lengthy description, given that it was coming from Alf. Taxi pulls into the street. Elsa thinks of Granny's stories about the Princess of Miplorus.
"So, you've been in love with Britt Marie since you were 10 years old?" she asks.
"Yes,"
Alf replies, as if it was absolutely self-evident. Bowled over by this, Elsa looks at him and waits because she knows that only by waiting will she get him to tell the whole story. You know things like that when you're almost 8. She waits for as long as she needs to. Then after 2 red lights, Alf sighs resignedly, like you do while preparing yourself to tell a story even though you don't like telling stories. And then he recounts the tale of Britt Marie, and himself, although the latter part may not be his intention. There are quite a lot of swear words in it, and Elsa has to exert herself quite a lot not to correct the grammar. But after a lot of ifs and buts and quite a few damneds, Alf has explained that he and Kent grew up with their mother in the flat where Alf now lives. When Alf was 10, another family moved into the flat above theirs with 2 daughters of the same age as Alf and Kent. The mother was a renowned singer, and the father wore a suit and was always at work. The elder sister, Ingrid, apparently had an outstanding singing talent. She was going to be a star, her mother explained to Alf and Kent's mother. She never said anything about the other daughter, Britt Marie. Alf and Kent caught sight of her anyway. It was impossible not to. No one remembers exactly when the young female medical student first showed up in the house. One day she was just there in the enormous flat that took up the entire top floor of the house in those days. And when Alf and Kent's mother interrogated her about why she lived by herself in such a big flat, the young female medical student replied that she'd won it in a game of poker. She wasn't at home a great deal, of course, and whenever she was always accompanied by outlandish friends and, from time to time, stray dogs. One evening she brought home a large black cur that she'd apparently also won in a game of poker, Alf explains. Alf and Kent and the daughters of the neighbouring family only wanted to play with it. They didn't understand that it was sleeping. Alf was quite certain it never meant to bite Britt Marie. It was just caught unawares. She was too. The dog disappeared after that, but Britt Marie's mother still hated the young medical student, and nothing anyone said could make her change her mind. And then came the car accident in the street, just outside the house. Britt Marie's mother never saw the lorry. The impact shook the whole building. The mother emerged from the front seat of the car with nothing worse than a few grazes, reeling and confused. But no one came out of the back seat. The mother screamed the most terrible of screams when she saw all the blood. The young medical student came running out in her nightie, her whole face full of cinnamon bun crumbs, and she saw the 2 girls in the back seat. She had no car of her own, and she could only carry 1 girl. She wedged the door open and saw that one of them was breathing and the other wasn't. She picked up the girl who was still breathing and ran all the way to the hospital. Alf goes silent. Elsa asks what happened to the sister. Alf is silent for 3 red lights. Then he says in a voice heavy with bitterness, "It's a terrible bloody thing when a parent loses a child. That family was never properly whole again. It wasn't the mother's fault. It was a bastard car accident. It was no one's fault. But she probably never got over it, and she damned well never forgave your grandmother."
"For what?"
"Because she thought your grandmother saved the wrong daughter."
Elsa's silence feels like 100 red lights.
"Was Kent
also in love with Brit Marie? She asks at last.
We're brothers. Brothers compete.
And Kent won?
A sound comes from Alf's throat. Elsa can't quite tell if it's a cough or a laugh.
Like hell, I won.
What happened then?
Kent moved, got married. Too damned young to a nasty piece of work. Had the twins, David and Pernilla. He loves those kids, but that woman made him bloody unhappy.
What about you and Brit Marie?
One red light. One more. We were young. People are bloody idiots when they're young. I went away. She stayed here.
Where did you go?
To a war.
Elsa stares at him. Were you also a soldier?
Alf pulls his hand through his lack of hair.
I'm old, Elsa. I've been a hell of a lot of things.
What happened to Brit Marie then?
I was on my way home. She was going to come and give me a surprise, and she saw me with another woman.
You had an affair?
Yes.
Why?
Because people are bloody idiots when they're young. Red light.
Then what did you do?
Asks Elsa.
Went away, he answers.
For how long?
Bloody long.
And Kent?
He got divorced. Moved back in with Mum. Brit Marie was still there. Yeah, what the hell, he'd always loved her, so when her parents died, they moved into their flat. Kent had got wind of the owners maybe selling the old place as leasehold flats, so they stayed on and waited for the dough. They got married and Brit Marie probably wanted children, but Kent thought the ones he already had were bloody enough. And now things are the way they are.
Elsa opens and closes taxi's glove compartment.
Why did you come home from the wars, then?
Some wars finish. And Mum got ill. Someone had to take care of her.
Didn't Kent do that?
Alf's nails wander round his forehead, like nails do when wandering among memories and opening doors that have long been closed.
Kent took care of Mum while she was still alive. He's an idiot, but he was always a good son. You can't take that away from the bastard. Mum never lacked for anything while she was alive, so I took care of her while she was dying.
And then?
Alf scratches his head, doesn't seem to know the exact answer himself.
Then I just sort of stayed on.
Elsa looks at him with seriousness, takes a deep, concluding breath, and says,
I like you very much, Alf, but you were a bit of a shit when you went away like that.
Alf coughs, or laughs, again. After the next red light, he mutters,
Brit Marie took care of your mother when her father died. While your grandmother was still travelling a lot, you know. She wasn't always the nagbag, as she is now.
I know,
says Elsa.
Did your grandmother tell you that?
In a way. She told me a story about a princess in a kingdom of sorrow, and two princes who loved her so much that they began to hate each other, and the worsers were driven into exile by the princess's parents, but then the princess fetched them back when the war came, and about a witch who stole a treasure from the princess.
She goes silent, crosses her arms, turns to Alf.
I was the treasure, right?
Alf sighs.
Oh, I'm not so big on fairy tales.
You can make an effort.
Brit Marie has given her whole life to being there for a man who is never home and trying to make someone else's children love her. When your grandfather died and she could be there for your mother, it was perhaps the first time she felt.
He seems to be looking for the right word. Elsa gives it to him.
Needed.
Yes.
And then Mum grew up.
She moved away, went to university, the house went bloody quiet for a bloody long time. And then she came back with your father and was pregnant.
I was going to be all of Brit Marie's second chances,
Elsa says in a low voice, nodding.
And then your grandmother came home, says Alf,
and stops by a stop sign. They don't say a lot more about that. Like you don't when there's not a great deal more to be said. Alf briefly puts his hand on his chest, as if something is itching under his jacket. Elsa looks at the zip.
Did you get that scar in a war?
Alf's gaze becomes somewhat defensive. She shrugs.
You've got a massive scar on your chest. I saw it when you were wearing your dressing gown. You really should buy yourself a new dressing gown, by the way.
I was never in that sort of war. No one ever fired at me.
So that's why you're not broken?
Broken like who?
Sam? And Wolfheart?
Sam was broken before he became a soldier, and not all soldiers are like that, but if you see the shit those boys saw, you need some help when you get back. And this country's so bloody willing to put billions into weapons and fighter jets, but when those boys come home and they've seen the shit they've seen, no one can be bothered to listen to them even for 5 minutes. He looks gloomily at Elsa. People have to tell their stories, Elsa, or they suffocate.
Where did you get the scar, then?
It's a pacemaker.
Oh.
You know what it is? Alf asks, skeptically. Elsa looks slightly offended. You really are a different damned kid.
It's good to be different.
I know. They drive up the motorway while Elsa tells Alf that Iron Man, who's a kind of superhero, has a type of pacemaker. But really it's more of an electromagnet, because Iron Man has shrapnel in his heart, and without the magnet, the shrapnel would cut holes in it, and then he'd die. Alf doesn't look as though he entirely understands the finer points of the story, but he listens without interrupting.
But they operate on him and remove the magnet at the end of the third film,
Elsa tells him excitedly. Then she clears her throat and adds, slightly shamefaced,
spoiler alert. Sorry.
Alf doesn't look as if this is concerning him very much. To be entirely honest, he doesn't look as if he knows exactly what a spoiler is, unless it's a part of a car. It's snowing again, and Elsa decides that even if people she likes have been shits on earlier occasions, she has to learn to carry on liking them. You'd quickly run out of people if you had to disqualify all those who at some point have been shits. She thinks to herself that this will have to be the moral of this story. Christmas stories are supposed to have morals. Alf's telephone rings from the compartment between the seats. He checks the display and sees it's Kent's number. He doesn't answer. It rings again.
Aren't you going to answer?
Wonders Elsa. It's Kent.
Suppose he wants to mouth off about some crap to do with the accountant and those leasehold conversion bastards, that's all he ever thinks about. He can bloody go on about it tomorrow, mutters Alf.
The telephone rings again. Alf doesn't answer. It rings a third time. Elsa picks it up, irritated, and answers even though Alf swears at her. There's a woman at the other end. She's crying. Elsa hands the phone to Alf. It trembles against his ear. His face becomes transparent. It's Christmas Eve. The taxi makes a U-turn. They go to the hospital. Alf doesn't stop for a single red light. Elsa sits on a bench in a corridor talking to Mum on the telephone, while Alf is in a room talking to a doctor. The nurses think Elsa is a grandchild, so they tell her that he had a heart attack, but he's going to be all right. There's a young woman standing outside the room. She's crying and she's beautiful. Smells strongly of perfume. She smiles faintly at Elsa and Elsa smiles back. Alf steps out of the room and nods without smiling at the woman. The woman disappears out of the door without meeting his eyes. Alf doesn't say a word, just marches back to the entrance and out into the car park with Elsa behind him. And only then does Elsa see Britt Marie. She's sitting absolutely still on the bench, wearing nothing but her floral print jacket, although it's below freezing. She's forgotten her brooch. The paintball stain is shining. Britt Marie's cheeks are blue, and she's spinning her wedding ring on her finger. She has one of Kent's shirts in her lap. It smells freshly laundered and has been perfectly ironed.
Britt Marie?
Alf's voice rasps out in the evening gloom, and he stops a meter from her. She doesn't answer, just lets her hand wander over the shirt collar in her lap gently brushes away something invisible from a fold. Carefully folds one cuff under the other. Straightens out a wrinkle that isn't there. Then she lifts her chin, looks old. Every word seems to leave a little track on her face.
"I've actually been absolutely brilliant at pretending, Alf," she whispers firmly.
Alf doesn't answer. Britt Marie looks down into the snow and spins her wedding ring.
"When David and Penelo were small, they always said I was so bad at coming up with stories. I always wanted to read the ones that were in books. They always said, make one up. But I don't understand why one should sit there and make things up just like that. When there are books where everything has been written down from the very start. I really don't."
She had raised her voice now as if someone needed convincing.
"Britt Marie," Alf says quietly, but she interrupts him coldly. "Kent told the children I couldn't make up stories because I didn't have any imagination. But it isn't true. It's not. I have an absolutely excellent imagination. I am very good at pretending."
Alf runs his fingers across his head and blinks for a long time. Britt Marie caresses the shirt in her lap as if it was a baby about to go to sleep.
"I always bring a newly washed shirt if I'm meeting him somewhere, because I don't use perfume."
Her voice grows muted. "David and Penilla never came for Christmas dinner. They were busy, they said."
"I can understand they're busy. They've been busy for years." "So Kent called and said he was staying at the office for a few hours. Just a few hours. He was having another conference call with Germany. Even though it's actually Christmas in Germany as well, but he never came home. So I tried calling him. He didn't answer. I left a message. Eventually the telephone rang, but it wasn't Kent."
Her lower lip trembles.
"I don't use perfume, but she does. So I always see to it that he has a fresh shirt. That's all I ask, that he should put his shirt directly in the washing machine when he comes home. Is that so much to ask?"
"Please, Britt Marie." She swallows spasmodically and spins her wedding ring.
"It was a heart attack, I know that, because she called and told me, Alf. She called me, because she couldn't stand it, she couldn't. She said she couldn't sit there in the hospital and know that maybe Kent would die without my knowing. She simply couldn't stand it."
She puts one hand in the other, closes her eyes and adds in a quivering voice,
"I have an excellent imagination, actually. It is excellently good. Kent always said he was going for dinners with the Germans, or that the plane was delayed by snow, or that he was just passing by the office for a bit, and then I pretended I believed it. I pretended so brilliantly that I believed it myself."
She rises from the bench, turns round, and hangs the shirt elaborately on the edge of the bench, as if she could not allow herself even now to take out her feelings on something freshly ironed.
"I'm very good at pretending," she whispers.
"I know that," whispers Alf. And then they leave the shirt on the bench and go home. It has stopped snowing. They travel in silence. Mum comes to meet them at the front entrance. She hugs Elsa, tries to hug Britt Marie. Britt Marie keeps her at a distance. Not vehemently, just with determination.
"I don't hate her, Ulrika," she says.
"I know," Mum says, with a slow nod.
"I don't hate her, and I don't hate the dog, and I don't hate her car."
Mum nods and takes her hand. Britt Marie closes her eyes.
"I don't hate at all, Ulrika. I actually don't. I only wanted you to listen to me. Is that so much to ask? I just didn't want you to leave the car in my place. I actually just didn't want you to come and take my place."
She spins her wedding ring. Mum leads her up the stairs, her hand firmly but lovingly round the floral print jacket. Alf never shows up in the flat, but Santa does. The boy with the syndrome's eyes light up, as children's eyes do when someone tells them about ice cream and fireworks and climbing trees and splashing about in puddles. Maud sets an extra place at the table and gets out more gratin. Leonard puts on more coffee. George washes up. After the presents have been handed round, the boy and the woman in the black skirt sit on the floor and watch Cinderella on the TV. Britt Marie sits slightly ill at ease next to Elsa on the sofa. They peer at one another. They don't say anything, but probably this is their cessation of hostilities. So when Elsa's mum tells her she has to stop eating chocolate Santas now or she'll get a stomachache, and Elsa keeps eating them, Britt Marie doesn't say anything. And when the evil stepmother turns up in Cinderella, and Britt Marie discreetly gets up and straightens out a crease in her skirt and goes into the hall to cry, Elsa follows her. And they sit on the chest together and eat chocolate Santas. Because you can be upset while you're eating chocolate Santas, but it's much, much, much more difficult. Chapter 31. Peanut Cake. The fifth letter drops into Elsa's lap, literally. She wakes the next morning in Granny's magic wardrobe. The boy sleeps, surrounded by his dreams, with the Moo Gun in his arms. The worse has dribbled a bit on Elsa's jumper, and it's set like cement. She lies in the darkness for a long time, breathing in the smell of wood shavings. She thinks about the Harry Potter quotation that Granny nicked for one of her stories from The Land of Almost Awake. It's from Harry Potter and the Order of the Phoenix, which is obviously ironic, and to understand this one would need to be fairly well informed about the differences between the Harry Potter books and Harry Potter films, as well as fairly well informed about the meaning of ironic. Because Harry Potter and the Order of the Phoenix is the Harry Potter film Elsa likes the least, in spite of it having one of the Harry Potter quotations Elsa likes best. The one where Harry says that he and his friends have one advantage in the approaching war with Voldemort, because they have one thing that Voldemort doesn't have. Something worth fighting for. It's ironic, because that quotation isn't in the book, which Elsa likes a lot more than the film, though the book is not one of her favourite Harry Potter books. Now, when she thinks of it, possibly it isn't ironic after all. She has to Wikipedia this properly, she thinks, sitting up. And that is when the letter drops into her lap. It's been taped to the wardrobe ceiling. She has no idea how long it's been there, but this sort of thing is logical in fairy tales. A minute later, Alf is standing in his doorway. He's drinking coffee and looks like he hasn't slept all night. He looks at the envelope. It just says Alf on it, in unnecessarily large letters.
I found it in the wardrobe. It's from Granny. I think she wants to say sorry about something,
Elsa informs him. Alf makes a shush sound and points to the radio behind him, which she really doesn't appreciate. There's the traffic news on the radio.
There's been some damned accident up on the motorway. All city-bound traffic has been stuck for hours, he says, as if this is something that will interest Elsa.
It doesn't. She's too interested in the letter. Alf only reads it after a lot of nagging.
What does it say, then?
Elsa demands the second he seems to have finished.
He says sorry.
Yes, but sorry for what?
Alf sighs in the way he's generally been sighing at Elsa lately.
It's my damned letter, isn't it?
Does she write sorry for always saying that you didn't lift your feet when you walked and that's why you have such worn-out shoes?
What's wrong with my shoes?
Says Alf, looking at his shoes. This doesn't seem to have been one of the themes of the letter.
Nothing, there's nothing at all wrong with your shoes, mumbles Elsa.
I've had these shoes for more than 5 years.
They're very nice shoes,
Elsa lies. Alf doesn't quite look as if he trusts her. Again, he looks down at the letter skeptically.
Me and your grandmother had a bloody row before she died, all right. Just before she had to go to the hospital. She'd borrowed my electric screwdriver and never bloody bothered to give it back, but she said she bloody had given it back, even though I knew damn well she never bloody did.
Elsa sighs in that way she's started generally sighing at Alf lately.
Did you ever hear about the bloke who swore himself to death?
No,
says Alf, as if the question was seriously meant. Elsa rolls her eyes.
What does Granny write about the electric screwdriver, then?
She just writes, "Sorry for losing it."
He folds up the letter and puts it back in the envelope. Elsa stubbornly stays where she is.
"What else? I saw there was more than that in the letter. I'm not an idiot, you know."
Alf puts the envelope on the hat shelf. "It says, sorry about loads of things."
"Is it complicated?"
"There wasn't a crap in your grandmother's life that wasn't complicated."
Elsa presses her hands further into her pockets, peers down her chin at the Gryffindor emblem on her scarf, at the stitches where Mum mended it after the girls at school had torn it. Mum still thinks it tore when Granny climbed the fence at the zoo.
"Do you believe in life after death?"
she asks Alf, without looking at him.
"Haven't got a bloody clue," says Alf,
not unpleasantly and not all pleasantly, just in a very Alf-like way.
"I mean, like, do you believe in paradise, sort of thing?"
mumbles Elsa. Alf drinks his coffee and thinks about it.
"It would be bloody complicated, logistically, I mean. Paradise must be where there aren't so many damn people," he mutters at last.
Elsa considers this, realizes the logic of it. Paradise for Elsa is, after all, a place where Granny is. But paradise for Britt Marie must probably be a place totally dependent on Granny not being there.
"You're quite deep sometimes," she says to Alf.
He drinks coffee and looks as if he finds that a bit of a bloody mouthful for an 8-year-old. Elsa is intending to ask him something else about the letter, but she never has time. And when she looks back, she will think that if she'd made some different choices, this day would not have worked out as terribly as it did in the end. But by then, it's too late for that. And Dad is standing on the stairs behind her. He's out of breath, which is not at all like Dad. Elsa's eyes open wide when she sees him, and then she looks at Alf's flat, at the radio. Because there's no coincidence in fairy tales. And there's a Russian playwright who once said that if there's a pistol hanging on the wall in the first act, it has to be fired before the last act is over. Elsa knows that, and those who can't understand by now how Elsa understands things like that just haven't been paying attention. So Elsa understands that the whole thing with the radio and the accident on the motorway must have something to do with the fairy tale they're in.
"Is it Mum?"
she manages to say. Dad nods and throws a nervous glance at Alf. Elsa's face trembles.
"Is she at the hospital?"
"Yes, she was called in this morning to take part in a meeting. There was some kind of
Dad starts, but Elsa interrupts him.
"She was in the car accident, wasn't she, the one on the motorway?"
Dad looks spectacularly puzzled. "What accident?"
"The car accident,"
Elsa repeats, quite beyond herself.
"No, no."
And then he smiles.
"You're someone's big sister now. Your mum was at the meeting when her waters broke."
It doesn't quite go into Elsa's head. It really doesn't. It's quite obvious, although she's very familiar with what happens when the waters break.
"But the car accident, what's it got to do with a car accident?"
she mumbles. Dad looks breathtakingly tentative.
"Nothing, I think, or, I mean, what do you mean?"
Elsa looks at Alf, looks at Dad, thinks about it so hard that she feels the strain right inside her sinuses.
"Where's George?"
she asks.
"At the hospital," answers Dad.
"How did he get there? They said on the radio all traffic on the motorway is stuck."
"He ran," says Dad, with a small twinge of what Dad's experience when they have to say something positive about the new guy.
And that's when Elsa smiles.
"George is good in that way," she whispers.
"Yes," Dad admits.
And she decides that maybe the radio by now has in some way earned its place in this fairy tale, in spite of it all. Then she bursts out anxiously.
"But how are we going to get to the hospital if the motorway is blocked?"
"You take the old bloody road," Alf says impatiently.
Dad and Elsa look at him as if he just spoke to them in a make-believe language. Alf sighs.
"The old road, damn it. Past the old abattoir, where that factory used to be where they made heat exchangers before the bastards moved everything to Asia. You can take that road to the hospital.
Young people today, I tell you, they think the whole bloody world is a motorway. And there's the moment right there when Elsa is thinking that she and the worse will go in taxi. But then she changes her mind and decides they'll go in Audi instead, because she doesn't want Dad to be upset. And if she hadn't changed her mind, it's possible that the day wouldn't have ended up as loathsome and terrible as it will soon become. Because when terrible things happen, one always thinks, if I only hadn't. And afterwards, this will turn out to be one of those moments. Maud and Leonard also decide they will come along to the hospital. Maud has brought biscuits, and Leonard decides when he gets to the entrance to bring the coffee percolator because he's worried they may not have one at the hospital. And even if they do, Leonard has the feeling it will probably be one of those modern coffee makers with a lot of buttons. Leonard's percolator only has one button. Leonard is very fond of that button. The boy with the syndrome and his mother also come along, also the woman in jeans, because they're sort of a team now, which Elsa is very pleased about. Mum told her yesterday that now, when so many people are living in Granny's flat, the whole house feels like that house Elsa always goes on about, where all the X-Men live. She rings on Britt Marie's door as well, but no one opens it. In retrospect, Elsa will recall that she paused briefly by the locked pram in the stairwell. The notice with the crossword was still on the wall above it. And someone had solved it. All the squares were filled. In pencil. If Elsa had stopped and reflected a little on it, maybe things would have turned out differently. But she didn't, so they didn't. It's possible that the worse hesitated for a moment outside Britt Marie's door. Elsa would have understood if it had done that, just like she supposes that worses hesitate sometimes when they're unsure about who in this fairy tale they've really been sent to protect. Worses actually guard princesses in normal fairy tales, and even in the land of Almost Awake, Elsa was never more than a knight. Yet if the worse had any hesitation, it didn't show it. It went with Elsa, because that's the sort of friend it is. If it hadn't gone with Elsa, maybe things would have worked out differently. Alf convinces the police to make a pass round the block to make sure everything is safe. Elsa never finds out exactly what he says to them, but Alf can be quite persuasive when he wants to be. Maybe he says that he's seen footprints in the snow, or heard someone in the house on the other side of the street tell him something. Elsa doesn't know, but she sees the summer intern policeman get into the car, and Green Eyes do the same after lengthy deliberation. Elsa meets her gaze for a second, and if she had only told Green Eyes the truth about the worse, then maybe everything would have ended up differently. But she didn't, because she wanted to protect the worse. Because that's the sort of friend she is. Alf goes back into the house and down into the garage to fetch taxi. When the police car swings round the corner at the top of the street, Elsa and the worse and the boy with the syndrome scurry out of the front entrance and across the street and into Audi, which is parked there. The children jump in first. The worse stops mid-step. Its hackles rise. Probably only a few seconds go by, but it feels like forever. Afterwards, Elsa will remember that it felt both as if she had time to think a billion thoughts and as if she didn't have time to think at all. There's a smell inside Audi that makes her feel surprisingly peaceful. She doesn't quite know why. She looks at the worse through the open window, and before she has time to realize what's about to happen, she wonders if maybe it doesn't want to jump into the car because it's in pain. She knows it is feeling pain. Pain the way Granny had pain everywhere in her body at the end. Elsa starts getting out a biscuit from her pocket, because no real friend of a worse would leave home nowadays without at least one biscuit for emergencies. But she doesn't have time, of course, because she realizes what is causing that smell in Audi. Sam comes darting out from behind the back seat. Elsa feels the coldness against her lips when his hand closes over her mouth. His muscles tense round her throat. She feels the hairs on his skin scraping like gravel through the gaps in the Gryffindor scarf. She has time to see the brief confusion in Sam's eyes when he sees the boy. It's the moment when he realizes he's been hunting the wrong child. She has time to understand that the shadows in the fairy tale didn't want to kill the chosen one, only steal him, make him their own, kill whoever stood in their way. and then the worser's jaws close round Sam's other wrist, just as he's making a grab for the boy. Sam roars. Elsa has a split second to react when he lets go of her. She sees the knife in the rear mirror, and everything after that is black. Elsa can feel herself running. She feels the boy's hand in hers, and she knows that they have to make it to the front entrance. They have to have time to scream so Dad and Alf can hear them. Elsa sees her feet moving, but she's not guiding them herself. Her body is running by instinct. She thinks that she and the boy have had time to make half a dozen steps when she hears the worse howling in horrendous pain, and she doesn't know if it's the boy who lets go of her hand or if she lets go of his. Her pulse is beating so hard that she can feel it in her eyes. The boy slips and falls to the ground. Elsa hears the back door of Audi opening and sees the knife in Sam's hand. Sees the blood on it. She does the only thing she can do, picks the boy up as best she can, and runs as fast as possible. She's good at running, but she knows it won't be enough. She can hear Sam straining behind her, feels the tug at her arm as the boy is torn from her grasp. Her heart lurches. She closes her eyes, and the next thing she remembers is the pain in her forehead, and Maud's scream, and Dad's hands. The hard floor in the stairwell. The world spins until it lands, swaying upside down in front of her, and she thinks that this must be how it is when you die. Like falling inwards, towards who knows what. She hears banging without understanding where it comes from. And the echo. Echo. She has time to think, and realizes she is indoors. She feels as if she's got gravel under her eyelids. She hears the light feet of the boy running up the stairs, as a boy's feet can run only when they have known for many years that this could happen. She hears the terrified voice of the boy's mother, trying to keep herself calm and methodical as she runs after him, as only a mother can do, and only when she has grown accustomed to fear as the natural state of things. The door of Granny's house is closed and locked behind them. Elsa feels that Dad's hands aren't holding her up, they're holding her back. She doesn't know from what, until she sees the shadow through the glass in the entrance door. Sees Sam on the other side. He's standing still, and something about his face is so deeply uncharacteristic of him that at first Elsa can't quite shake off the feeling that she is imagining the whole thing. Sam is afraid. In the blink of an eye, another shadow descends over him, so enormous that Sam's shadow is engulfed in it. Wolfheart's heavy fists rain down with fury, with a violence and a darkness no fairy tale could describe. He doesn't hit Sam. He hammers him into the snow. Not to make him harmless. Not to protect. To destroy. Elsa's dad picks her up and runs up the stairs, presses her against his jacket so she can't see. She hears the door flung open from inside, and she hears Maud and Leonard pleading with Wolfheart to stop hitting, stop hitting, stop hitting. But judging by the dull thumping sounds, like when you drop milk cartons on the floor, he isn't stopping. He doesn't even hear them. In the tales, Wolfheart fled into the dark forests long before the war without end, because he knew what he was capable of. Elsa tears herself free of Dad and sprints down the stairs. Maud and Leonard stop screaming before she's reached the bottom. Wolfheart's mallet of a fist is raised so high above Sam that it brushes the stretched-out fingers of the cloud animals before it turns back and hurtles down. But Wolfheart freezes in the middle of the movement. Between him and the blood-covered man stands a woman who looks so small and frail that the wind should be able to pass right through her. She has an insignificant ball of blue tumble-dryer fluff in her hand, and a thin white line on her finger where her wedding ring used to be. Every ounce of her being seems to be yelling at her to run for her life. But she stays where she is, staring at Wolfheart with the resolute gaze of someone who has nothing left to lose. She rolls up the tumble-dryer fluff in the palm of one hand and puts that hand against her other hand and clasps them together on her stomach. Then she looks with determination at Wolfheart and says with authority, "We don't beat people to death in this leaseholders association." Wolfheart's fist is still vibrating in the air. His chest
heaves up and down, but his arms slowly fall down at his sides. She is still standing between Wolfhart and Sam, between the monster and the shadow, when the police car comes skidding into their street. The green-eyed policewoman jumps out, her weapon drawn, long before the car has stopped. Wolfhart has dropped on his knees in the snow. Elsa shoves the door open and charges outside. The police roar at Wolfhart. They try to stop Elsa, but it's like holding water in cupped hands. She slips through their fingers. For reasons she won't understand for many years, Elsa has time to think about what her mother said to George once when she thought Elsa was sleeping. That this is how it is, being the mother of a daughter who is starting to grow up. The worst lies immobile on the ground, halfway between Audi and the front entrance. The snow is red. It tried to get to her, crawled out of Audi and crept along until it collapsed. Elsa wriggles out of her jacket and the Gryffindor scarf and spreads them over the animal's body, curling up in the snow next to it and hugging it hard, hard, feeling how its breath smells of peanut cake, and she whispers, "Don't be afraid, don't be afraid," over and over again into its ear. "Don't be afraid, don't be afraid, Wolfhart has defeated the dragon, and no fairy tales can end until the dragon has been defeated." When she feels Dad's soft hands picking her up off the ground, she calls out loudly so the worst will hear her, even if it's already halfway to the land of almost awake.
"You can't die! You hear? You can't die because all Christmas tales have happy endings!"
Chapter 32 Glass. It's hard to reason about death. Hard to let go of someone you love. Granny and Elsa used to watch the evening news together. Now and then Elsa would ask Granny why grown-ups were always doing such idiotic things to each other. Granny usually answered that it was because grown-ups were generally people, and people are generally shits. Elsa countered that grown-ups were also responsible for a lot of good things in between all the idiocy. Space exploration, the UN, vaccines and cheese slices, for instance. Granny then said the real trick of life was that almost no one is entirely a shit, and almost no one is entirely not a shit. The hard part of life is keeping as much on the not-a-shit side as one can. Once Elsa asked why so many not-shits had to die everywhere, and why so many shits don't, and why anyone at all had to die, whether a shit or not. Granny tried to distract Elsa with ice cream and change the subject, because Granny preferred ice cream to death. But Elsa was capable of being a bewilderingly obstinate kid, so Granny gave up in the end and admitted that she supposed something always had to give up its own space so that something else could take its place.
"Like when we're on the bus and some old people get on?" asked Elsa.
And then Granny asked Elsa if she'd agree to more ice cream and another topic of conversation if Granny answered yes. Elsa said she could go for that. In the oldest fairy tales from Miamis, they say a worse can die only of a broken heart, otherwise they're immortal. This is why it became possible to kill them after they were sent into exile from the land of almost awake for biting the princess, because they were sent away by the very people they had protected and loved.
"And that was why they could be killed in the last battle of the War Without End," Granny explained,
for hundreds of worses died in that last battle.
"Because the hearts of all living creatures are broken in war."
Elsa thinks about that while sitting in the waiting room at the veterinary surgery. It smells of birdseed. Britt Marie sits next to her with her hands clasped together in her lap, watching a cockatoo sitting in its cage on the other side of the room. Britt Marie doesn't seem so very keen on cockatoos. Elsa isn't wholly conversant with the exact emotional utterances of cockatoos, but she reckons the feeling is mutual.
"You don't have to wait here with me," says Elsa, her voice clogged with sorrow and anger.
Britt Marie brushes some invisible seeds from her jacket and answers, without taking her eyes off the cockatoo.
"It's no trouble, dear Elsa. You shouldn't feel like that. No trouble at all."
Elsa understands that she doesn't mean it unpleasantly. The police are interviewing Dad and Alf about everything that has happened,
and Britt Marie was the first to be questioned, so she offered to sit with Elsa and wait for the veterinary surgeon to come out and say something about the worse. So Elsa does understand that there's nothing unpleasant about it. It's just difficult for Britt Marie to say anything at all without it sounding that way. Elsa wraps her hands in her Gryffindor scarf, inhales deeply.
"It was very brave of you to step between Wolfhart and Sam,"
she offers in a low voice. Britt Marie brushes some invisible seeds and possibly some invisible crumbs from the table in front of her into the palm of her hand. Sits there with her hand closed round them, as if looking for an invisible waste paper bin to throw them in.
"As I said, we don't beat people to death in this leaseholders' association,"
she replies quickly, so Elsa can't hear how her emotion is overwhelming her. They are silent, as you are when you make peace for the second time in 2 days, but don't quite want to spell it out to the other person. Britt Marie fluffs up a cushion at the edge of the waiting room sofa.
"I didn't hate your grandmother," she says,
without looking at Elsa.
"She didn't hate you either,"
says Elsa, without looking back.
"And actually, I've never wanted the flats to be converted to leaseholds. Kent wants it, and I want Kent to be happy, but he wants to sell the flat and make money and move.